major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Well, I think we've come full circle. Napoleon Bonaparte said that the French Revolution started with the diamond necklace affair because Marie Antoinette's name got discredited in it, and through her, the entire monarchy got discredited.
My working definition of boredom is that boredom is the incapacity to be engaged. To be engaged with action, or to be engaged with what you're looking at, or to be engaged with the external world at any given minute.
Scandal and boredom, two conversations this week on Soundings. First, Sarah Mazza of Northwestern University discusses the diamond necklace scandal of the French Revolution. Following that, Patricia Meyer Spax of the University of Virginia discusses boredom as a cultural phenomenon. According to Sarah Mazza, the diamond necklace scandal increases our understanding of gender and sexuality in French revolutionary culture. Here is Sarah Mazza.
Well, I've been working recently on a famous scandal called the Diamond Necklace Affair, which historians have neglected for, over a generation because they assume it's sort of irrelevant to the real origins of the French Revolution, but I think it does have a lot to tell us, in fact.
Who are the main players?
The main characters are, first of all, a woman named Madame de la Motte. At least that was one of her names. She was born Jeanne de Saint-Rémy, and she was the daughter of a very poor, ruined noble family. But she called herself de Valois because she claimed that she descended from the French royal family, and that was basically that was the idea that she used to promote herself and to exercise her trade, if you will.
She was very politically ambitious. Have I got that right?
No, she was more of a con woman. She was financially ambitious.
All right.
She wanted to make money off gullible members of high society, and her royal name, her claim that she was somehow descended from the royal family, which apparently was true, was her ticket to her passport to high society.
How do hot diamonds come into this story, Sarah?
They come into the story because Madame de la Motte, she became Madame de la Motte after she married a rather poor and equally unscrupulous young man named Nicolas de la Motte. She then started to make money by acting as an intermediary between people who wanted to get in touch with members of the court, and specifically the queen.
And here's where the politics comes in.
Right, because she could play upon people's desire to have contact with the court and offer them that kind of access to the court, which for the most part was largely fictitious. Uh-huh. I mean, she really didn't have very much access, but she pretended. She was quite unscrupulous. She would forge letters from high personages at court. Anyway, so she was always looking for targets, for marks for her con games. I mean, she really was a kind of classic con woman, setting up very elaborate stings. And
enter the cardinal.
Enter the cardinal, Cardinal de Rohan, who was an extremely wealthy and powerful figure, a man of the cloth. He was a cardinal. He was the Grand Almoner of France. And the cardinal desperately wanted access to political power. He had been the ambassador to Vienna many years before and had alienated Marie Antoinette and was convinced that the queen was the main obstacle that stood between him and his political ambitions. And so Madame de la Motte, of course, approached him and said, "Well, I can get letters from you to my cousin, the queen." She was no cousin. Now these forgeries, of course, kept the cardinal going for a while, but the Countess de la Motte, as she called herself, decided that she needed something a little more persuasive to convince the cardinal to do what she eventually wanted him to do, which is lay out a good deal more money. Uh-huh. So in an act of quite amazing chutzpah, Madame de la Motte and her husband, Nicolas, went roaming around Paris until they found a young girl. She happened to be a prostitute, which made the case even worse when it came to light. She was a high-class prostitute, Nicole Leguet, and she looked amazingly like Marie Antoinette. So they had a seamstress dress Nicole in a costume that was similar to the one that was worn by the queen in a recent portrait.
They're going to go as far as setting up a meeting here between
them. Right. They're going to set up an impersonation. They did, however, have the good sense to set up the impersonation at the dead of night in the gardens of Versailles. And the cardinal was to meet his sovereign, and he did meet a woman who stammered a few words and handed a rose to him and then was whisked away. She was so nervous she almost blew it.
All right, now, but did the cardinal buy all of this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Hook, line, and sinker. He was really hooked at this point. And so the stage was set for the real coup that this had all been building up to, which was the purchase of a dime of the most famous and most expensive jewel in France, the diamond necklace that had been put together by the jewelers Beaumaire and Bassange, and that had been commissioned by Louis XV, the previous king, for
all
his
right,
mistress.
The con woman and her husband are setting up the cardinal as a mark to get him to buy the diamonds, and they're going to take off with the money.
Exactly. Is that it? Exactly. Well, they're going to take off with the necklace, which is exactly what happened. The cardinal started to pay. He couldn't pay the whole sum at once. Even he wasn't rich enough. He started to pay in installments. They got the necklace. And immediately, Madame de la Motte handed the necklace over to her husband, who took it apart. Unfortunately, this gorgeous necklace no longer exists.
So, do we have pictures of it?
Oh yes, We have. It was famous enough, so there were pictures made.
What was it worth, Sarah Maas? Anybody put a price on it?
It was worth, it's been estimated at 1.5 million livres.
Goodness.
And 1 livre was what a skilled artisan made in a day at that time.
So this represented a lot of money.
Yes, yes.
And you say that the jewels themselves, the necklace itself, was taken apart and what, sort of scattered hither and yon.
Right,
What about the money that changed hands? What happened to the cardinal?
Well, the cardinal was paying off the jewelers, and
I see.
This arrangement could have continued, and Madame de la Motte thought, of course, that she was protected by the cardinal's stature, that if the story came out to light...
Sure, his gullibility, he wouldn't want that out in public.
Right, his gullibility, and also the fact that he had been consorting with this adventuress, and she was known to be that, that he had been manipulating, using these lowlife types to manipulate his way into power. She thought that if the story came out, which eventually it would, of course it would become obvious at some point that the queen didn't have the necklace.
Did anybody go to jail over this thing? When did the story come to light?
The story came to light in August of 1785, and in fact the nation was completely stunned because after it the story came out because the jewelers contacted Marie Antoinette directly, and she said, "What necklace?"
Yeah.
And eventually they traced the story back.
Oh, goodness.
And the cardinal was arrested on August 15th, on Assumption Day of 1785. He was just about to conduct Assumption services at Versailles, and he was clad in full pontifical regalia. So it was quite a scandal. It became quite a topic, of course, for fashionable gossip and imitations. Once the cardinal was in, after the cardinal was thrown in prison, although it was, of course, a very comfortable prison, the ladies of Paris started wearing clothes that were red on gold, and they called this cardinal on straw.
Didn't you? You told me before our taping, Sarah Mazza, that this became the subject of a novel
by Alexandre Dumas. Uh-huh. Yes,
it's still read today.
In as much as Dumas is read, yes, it still is. It's a very good story.
What does this story that you've told us, Sarah Mazza, what does it have to do with the origins of the French Revolution? You began your comments by saying that the evidence here, some historians would look upon it as askance in a way. What tell me about that.
Well, I think we've come full circle. Napoleon Bonaparte said that the French Revolution started with the diamond necklace affair because Marie Antoinette's name got discredited in it, and through her, the entire monarchy got discredited. And people believed that for a long time, that when we still thought that politics was a question of individuals and that history was moved by individuals and personalities. That was a plausible enough explanation. Now, scholars of our generation would tend to see the long-term social and economic and even long-term sort of structural political forces as more significant. However, if you read the pamphlets that appeared in connection with the Diamond Necklace Affair, what you see coming out is the tremendous hostility towards women, towards what I call public women. The involvement of women in politics becomes increasingly abhorrent to people in the late 18th century as one marches towards the revolution. And what the pamphlets and the affair did was that they somehow, in the way in which they told the story, they somehow confused the person of Marie Antoinette with the person of this con woman and this prostitute. Uh-huh. They managed to suggest that even though the queen protested that she had not been in any way involved, and which is utterly true. I mean, in this case, she truly was victimized by this story. Everybody wanted to believe that somehow she was involved because there were these rumors about her political meddling and her personal misconduct that had been circulating for a long time. And I think beyond Marie Antoinette, it is the presence of women in the public sphere, in the political sphere, that was the target of this case, of this scandal.
Sarah, are you the one who's setting the record straight on this? Is this an original contribution to the scholarship of the French Revolution?
No, it's a rereading of the case.
I see.
I haven't discovered anything new about the trial. Almost everybody who's looked at the case agrees that it was set up by Madame de la Motte, that Rohan was nothing but stupid and gullible, and that Marie Antoinette had nothing to do with it. What I'm saying is you have to look beyond the details of this particular case, and use it to illuminate broader aspects of the culture in which it took place.
Sarah Mazza teaches at Northwestern University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a study of literature, law, and public opinion in 18th century French culture. Sarah Mazza is the author of Servants and Masters in 18th Century France, published in 1983. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a discussion featuring Patricia Meyer Spax of the University of Virginia. Patricia Meyer Spax is at work on a study of boredom as a cultural phenomenon. Pat Spax, welcome back to Soundings. We're about to approach a topic here that is the dread of every talk show host, and I suppose it haunts all you professors, too. Boredom. How in the world did you come to a topic like that?
Well, you've already suggested one good reason for coming to a topic like that. People talk about it all the time, although I've noticed that since I've been writing on boredom, every time I tell someone I'm writing about boredom, the response is immediately, oh, I'm never bored. So people act as though it's a social disease if they believe they're going to be accused of either being bored or being boring.
But it happens, and there's a lot of evidence for it in our culture, in our literature. Do you have a personal axe that you're grinding here? What was it that, I guess it's an odd counterpoint to say inspired you to boredom, huh?
Well, one answer to that question is to say that my last book was about gossip, and as I started thinking about a sequel to gossip, boredom seems the appropriate alternative to gossip.
Uh-huh.
But what actually stimulated me was a conversation with a friend in New Haven who remarked that she had been taught that it was a sin ever to say of another human being that he or she was boring. And I got very interested in the notion that there was sin associated with boredom, and started doing some investigating, and discovered that in the past, indeed, the association between sin and boredom was very strong. It was only in the 19th century that disappeared.
Well, that leads me to ask you, Pat Spax, as you write about boredom, are you writing about human nature, or are you talking about a social, what do we call it, a socially constructed notion? Where, for example, does it come from?
I am talking very definitely about a socially constructed notion, and a notion that originates at a very specific historical moment in its modern form. The word doesn't appear until the middle of the 18th century. And you know that English teachers are always fond of beginning their study of anything by looking up the word. But in this case, sure. The word is really significant, because the OED says that it has no derivation. It comes out of nowhere in the middle of the 18th century, as though in the middle of the 18th century, a word had to be invented for a condition that people were suddenly finding a problem in their lives. Now, it's true that before the 18th century, you can find evidence of a condition that we might describe as boredom, but you don't find people talking about it as a problem in their lives until the 18th century.
Well, let's look at an alternative way to describe this state, whatever it may be. The French word ennui comes to mind. Does etymologically, what do we have a disjuncture here? What's going on?
There's no relationship between the two words as words. The OED says rather amusingly that ennui is the French condition and boredom is the English condition. I think they actually suggest rather different things. In the book I'm writing, I am not talking about ennui, or I'm trying not to talk about ennui, which is a more cosmic condition. It's a condition of being discontent with the universe and feeling alienated from the universe. I'm interested in plain old garden variety boredom, you know, what you feel at a dull lecture.
Well, tell me, cite some examples for me, Pat Spax. What kind of evidence do you use? If the word originates in the middle of the 18th century, do I take it that your literary evidence moves from that point forward, or how are you constructing this?
My principal literary evidence moves from that point forward, and I'm concentrating really on novels. But using some autobiographical material too, it's very interesting. One particularly interesting instance is Gertrude Stein's autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, in which Stein tells the story of her own life, as well as purporting to tell the story of Alice B. Toklas's life. And she tells of her time in medical school at Johns Hopkins. And she finished 3 years of medical school with considerable distinction. And she says that for the first 2 years, she was having a wonderful time because there were lots of people and lots of stories. But at the beginning of the third year, she found that she was terribly bored. And at the end of the third year, she failed one of her exams. And everybody was terribly upset and surprised, because she'd been one of the most brilliant students. And they said, well, of course, you'll take the exam over again. And she said, no, I'm not going to take the exam over again. And one of her woman friends said, Gertrude, remember the cause of women. And Stein responded, you don't know what it is to be bored. And she thereupon quit medical school, went to Europe, and began being Gertrude Stein. But it seems to me very interesting that that should be her interpretation of what it was that made her stop aspiring to be a doctor and start aspiring to be a writer. In other words, to spend her life on people and stories. I am interested in the way in which women have been associated with boredom at various times and for various reasons, but they certainly have no monopoly on it.
What about recent examples? What do you look for? You said that you're dealing mainly with novels. How recent is your evidence?
Oh, I expect I could go right up to the minute, but among the books that I have thought about at least passingly so far are Saul Bellow's Humboldt's Gift, mm-hmm. in which the protagonist purports to be writing a book on boredom. There is no evidence that he's actually writing anything, but he has the opportunity to deliver himself of a number of pronouncements on boredom. The short stories and novels of Donald Barthelme, which are full of boredom as a problem. The novels and plays of Samuel Beckett. I suppose those are about the most recent examples I've thought of so far.
Does it matter to you, Pat Spax, who gets bored or what bores mm-hmm. whom? How do we figure out that relationship mm-hmm. or tension?
Well, that brings up one of the big questions about boredom, which is whether the causes are external or internal. When you say what bores whom, you're assuming that the causes are external.
Right.
In the 18th century, they assumed that the causes were always internal. And I think I'm sort of inclining toward that view. In other words, there are no external circumstances, I'm inclined to think, that could be called objectively boring. Boring is a word like interesting, and what it means is how you feel
right.
about things. One of the things I love about this project is that people give me a lot of help. And I don't mean by that they help me by being boring or being bored, but that people have a lot of ideas about this. One of the first times I spoke in public about it was at Harvard, and afterwards a woman sent me an essay by a psychoanalyst arguing that women, this is in the 20th century, that women are frequently misdiagnosed as suffering from depression when in fact they are suffering from boredom caused by the actual conditions of their lives. And that seemed to me a very interesting notion.
You made me think of, what is it, a short story or a novel, The Yellow Wallpaper, mm. about a woman who just finally goes over the mm-hmm. edge. Where would you mm-hmm. put that, boredom or depression?
Well, I think boredom has a lot to do with it. Ever since the beginning of the 19th century, writers have been writing very obsessively about the problem of being bored. One thing that I've noticed recently with great interest is how many advertisements in current periodicals draw on the fear of being bored. There is one that I'm fond of, the headline of which is "Fly around the world in the Concorde, everything else is boring."
And using this what solely to the advantage of the people who are making this particular pitch.
Well, that's right. And over again, you find in advertisements, there's a whiskey advertisement, there's a Waterman pen advertisement.
Right.
These advertisements draw on the fact that everybody finds it intolerable to imagine being bored, and the pitch is this product will prevent your boredom or will be a sign of the fact that you are really an interesting person leading an interesting life. But the fact that there are so many of these ads, and there really are a great many, suggests that the idea of boredom is really extremely important in our society. Another interesting reaction I had from an audience was when I spoke to a group of high school teachers, and they were extraordinarily interested in the topic, and it turned out the reason they were so interested was that they perceive it as the biggest problem they face in the classroom. They say that adolescents in the classroom are simply aggressively bored, and that it is just impossible to find anything that they are willing to show themselves interested in, and that fighting that boredom or that pose of boredom, and who knows which it is, uh-huh. Is the big task of a high school teacher today.
Oh, that's the badge of adolescence. You can't engage me. Nothing that you
Absolutely.
Can tell me is going to make me mm-hmm. sit up and take notice.
Yep.
Pat Spax, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Are you being descriptive or proscriptive in your view of boredom? Are you going to tell people how not to be bored, or are you simply going to say, this is what's happened historically and in literary terms? Approach it from that angle.
I certainly am not going to tell people how not to be bored. It is descriptive, but more than being descriptive, I suppose you could say that what I'm doing is something exploratory and meditative. What I'm interested in is thinking about what this phenomenon means and has meant in Western culture. I say Western culture very, very deliberately, because in Eastern culture, boredom is much more often recognized as a valuable and useful state, a state on the way to nirvana. But in Western culture, on the whole, boredom has been considered a very fearful problem. And I'm interested in thinking about how the problem developed, why it developed, when it did, how it's related to various other historical and cultural phenomena, and what it means in society that we are so extraordinarily interested in boredom.
I suppose this has something to do with what was it, W.H. Auden, who coined the term, who nicknamed us the Age of Anxiety, or what, a couple of, not a couple of generations, but 20 or 30 years ago. Does that connect with your interest in boredom, word anxiety?
I think anxiety is connected with boredom. I think depression is connected with boredom. I think rage is connected with boredom. A psychiatrist said to me that boredom was the midpoint between depression and rage, and I'm not sure that's not true. But I think the age of boredom might be at least as good a characterization of our own time as the age of anxiety.
Patricia Meyer Spax teaches at the University of Virginia. She's at work on a study of boredom as a cultural phenomenon. Previous books by Patricia Meyer Spax include studies of gossip, of the self, and of the female imagination. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 473. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be the American Cultural Canon and African American Literature. My guests will be Houston Baker of the University of Pennsylvania and Henry Louis Gates, Jr. of Duke University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, when President John F. Kennedy demanded the removal of Soviet missiles from Cuba. The opening of the original New York Metropolitan Opera House occurred during the latter part of October, 1883. The religious leader William Miller predicted the world would end 145 years ago this week, in October 1844. The first of the Federalist Papers, a series of essays supporting the new American Constitution and the new form of federal government, appeared during the last part of October, 1787. Birthdays for the fourth week in October include the Spanish artist Pablo Picasso, the Italian inventor of canned goods Nicholas Appert, and the first woman to swim the English Channel, Gertrude Ederle. Pablo Picasso was born during late October 1881, Nicholas Appert in 1752, and Gertrude Ederle in 1906. Finally, happy birthday this week to the Statue of Liberty. Frederick Bartholdi's sculpture of Liberty Enlightening the World was dedicated in New York Harbor in October 1886. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Scandal and Boredom, two conversations this week on Soundings. Sarah Mazza of Northwestern University discusses the Diamond Necklace Affair, an episode that illuminates the role of gender and sexuality in French revolutionary culture. Patricia Meyer Spax of the University of Virginia discusses boredom as a cultural phenomenon. Scandal and Boredom, this week on Soundings.